dodges. I ride in this wind on my good horse. I call you my shiny black bears to the playhouse of fortune to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else.
You're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, 101.1 Free Radio Santa Cruz, Free Radio Asheville, or WGDR Plainfield. This is Unwelcome Guests. I'm Lynn Gary. Last week, on the eve of the 35th anniversary of Earth Day, the troglodytes controlling the U.S. House of Representatives proved that they will go to any lengths to prop up our unsustainable, brutal, and wasteful system. By passing an energy bill that allows oil drilling in the Alaska Wildlife Refuge and funnels billions of dollars to highly profitable energy companies while doing little to promote conservation or ease gasoline prices. The bill's sponsors said oil from Alaska's Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, as much as 1 million barrels a day, will be needed to help curtail the country's growing dependence on oil imports. Opponents argued correctly that the oil wouldn't be available for a decade, and even then at levels that would not significantly affect oil prices or imports. Some expert sources have estimated that the oil in ANWR would last the United States less than 6 months if used all at once. But drilling it and selling it at today's high prices and the future's even higher prices will produce enormous profits for oil companies. The bill also calls for $8.1 billion in tax breaks over 10 years, most of it going to promote the dirty coal, deadly nuclear, and dwindling oil and natural gas industries. Senate Democrats have pledged to filibuster any energy bill that would open the refuge to oil companies. An amendment to strip the Alaska Refuge provision from the House energy bill failed, 231-200. Representative Ed Markey, a Democrat of Massachusetts who offered the amendment, noted that the bill does nothing to improve the fuel economy of automobiles, which use 70% of the country's oil. An attempt to require automakers to increase fuel economy to a fleet average of a mere 33 miles per gallon over the next decade was defeated, 254-177. The House bill would also make it easier to build liquefied natural gas import terminals, even if states or local communities oppose the project. And it would protect makers of the gasoline additive MTBE from product liability lawsuits stemming from the chemical's contamination of drinking water. The federal government response has been consistent in these respects. The nature and extent of the problem is concealed from the public, and the thrust of the policy solutions are geared at positioning the energy corporations to profit from disaster. I imagine that they are doing this because they are unwilling to confront dismantling the social and economic system which seems to be working so well for them, but will cease to, in spite of their efforts, ultimately work for anybody. In the meantime, they will have squandered the remaining precious resources needed to get humanity off to a new start toward a sustainable society. This week on the program, a candid discussion of problems and a creative look at solutions for humanity at the end of the age of cheap oil. First, we turn to Julian Darley, a journalist and activist on energy and post-oil sustainability issues. Darley is based in Vancouver, B.C., and is the founder of the Post-Carbon Institute and author of High Noon for Natural Gas. He was interviewed last winter by Matt Soltis of CFRU in Guelph, Ontario. Darley begins with a brief description of the scientific basis for oil peak.
So what is this problem, for those that haven't heard about it very much before? peak oil, as it's or oil peak, as it's referred to, is a phenomenon which is actually it's both a natural phenomenon and a man-made phenomenon, and it comes about because if you have a fluid in the ground in rocks, so not just in an underground lake, but actually in rocks, porous rocks, then that fluid, especially if it's viscous, as oil sometimes is, but not always, then it doesn't just come out like gasoline or petrol out of a petrol tank or gas tank, nor indeed does it come out as if you have an underground tank and you just simply pump it out. You know, the faster you pump the pump, the faster it comes out. It's really not like that at all. And so what happens is, because of the fact that at first oil is almost invariably pressurized, so it comes out on its own, but then the fact that it finds it difficult to travel in the rocks in which it's kept itself, if you like, for often millions of years, once the pressure's gone away, the flow of oil from a single well slows down and tails off. It doesn't just stop, almost never just stops. It tails off and you get lots of warning from this. Now, what this means is that because we don't drill a million oil wells in a single oil field the moment it's discovered, because if you did that, you'd simply drain the whole thing, but as soon as the pressure had gone off, it would drain away almost to nothing. But we don't do that. It's very expensive to do that, and we don't exactly know where to drill the oil wells immediately anyway. So, you know, the process of drilling the first few tells you where to drill the next ones in order to increase your chances of finding oil. So what all this means is that when you, let's say you find an oil field, or let's say onshore, because that's the way things started in 1859 with the first commercial oil field is usually regarded as being in America. There were a few others actually, in one in Canada and in Russia, but that's where we usually put the starting point in 1859 in Pennsylvania. So what happens is you find it, you start to develop it so that you can extract the oil or produce the oil, as it's said in the industry. And it comes out very, very quickly, and then you drill more wells, so it goes on coming out faster and faster. And so what happens is it rises up in usually a curve shape, and as you go on drilling more wells, both replacing those that are starting to decline, but also usually putting in more, and we're on the increasing side, if you like. We've still got plenty of oil in the reservoir and plenty of pressure. So the oil output increases for the field. We're not talking about for just one well. We're talking about several or indeed many wells. Goes on rising, and depending on economics and how many wells you put in and reservoir characteristics, it will go on rising, and eventually it will reach a peak. So if you imagine this thing as a mountain shape, or some people say a bell curve shape, goes on rising, then it reaches a peak. And then if you keep up the same general effort, then it will peak and it will start to go into decline. And if you keep the same general effort, the decline will very likely, more than likely, be a similar kind of shape to the way you started off. In other words, it's not good news if you're an oil producer or indeed highly dependent on oil that it's declining. But the good news part of it is that at least it's declining in an orderly sort of fashion, and you can make predictions about how it will go, and those predictions are pretty good. What tends to happen now is that sensing peak, although it's not very often admitted, but sensing that the flow is not increasing so fast, it's still enormous at the peak, of course, it's a large field, then the industry tends to put in a lot more wells and use special recovery techniques such as pumping in seawater or ordinary water, if you can get it, pumping in water, let's say, or some kind of gas like natural gas or carbon dioxide, to keep the flow going at a sort of plateau. So many fields show a kind of peak plateau. But that's because we've made special efforts. So that's the kind of picture. This was first put forward in 1956 by a man who's famous in these circles, Marion King Hubbert. He was the chief researcher for Shell in Houston. And he said at a conference in 1956, famously now, that the United States, then the world's largest producer and largest exporter, and to say oil was more or less to say the United States, not that there weren't other producers, extractors, he said that the United States would peak sometime between the late 60s and the early 70s, and after that there was nothing that the U.S. could do to bring production back to the same level. He was, I think it's fair to say, more or less ridiculed. He was a pretty tough fellow, and he evidently put up with this, but there was just, it was more or less a laughing stock, and remained so for many years, until lo and behold, in 1970, the U.S. did peak in its oil production, just over 9.5 million barrels a day. This is for the lower 48, so without Alaska, and without the Gulf of Mexico, which wasn't really in production then. And it started going down, and some people say it took 10 years before the U.S. really realized it was in this serious kind of decline, because you could always say, well, we peaked today, but we'll put in some more wells, and we'll get right back there tomorrow or next year. But it never happened. And this has become the archetypal classical historical case for oil peak. Began in the case of the U.S. with a burst in 1859, started really rising from 1901 with the first find of the first really giant oil field in Spindletop in Texas. And from 1901, just mainly a story of uninterrupted increase. There were a few bumps all the way to 1970, and then it's been in decline ever since. There was it got held up a little bit, although it was still in decline. There was a much lower peak around the late 1980s, which was the peak of Alaskan oil, which was more of a plateau, and then it went on going back down again, and now it's somewhere around half of what it was in 1970. And this is a very serious matter for the U.S., and it's noticeable, for instance, that the 1973 oil shock happened after the U.S. peaked. It would have been much harder to do, perhaps even impossible to do this before 1970, because the U.S. could have increased its oil production. It was slightly holding its oil production back until 1970, especially at Texas, so it could have at least mitigated some of the effects of the oil shock, the oil embargo of 1973. So that's one very obvious sign. And another obvious sign is the way in which energy policy of the U.S. has become increasingly militarized, so that there is, if you like, a confluence between energy policy and military policy and foreign policy, all of which is very unfortunate. In a nutshell, that's historically what happened to the U.S. The biggest example and the most important, really, and quite archetypal. And now the argument of those who are in the peak oil camp, of which I certainly am, the argument being put forward by the likes of Colin Campbell and Jean Laherrere and Walter Youngquist, Ken DeFays and a few others, sadly not a vast number of others, is that what happened to the U.S. is just about happening to the world. Can't be exactly sure when the moment of peak is, can't be sure what the shape of the peak plateau will look like. You know, will we hold it on for 2 or 3 years? Will we hold it on for longer? Will it go down more quickly than that? No one can be absolutely sure of this. There are too many other factors, including the biggest factor is economics, but there are other complex factors, such as attacks on oil wells and oil fields, strikes, all kinds of civil unrest, and so on, because I think it's fair to say that the oil industry has not conducted itself in the most perfect fashion, and as in Nigeria, there's a lot of unrest and about the way the profits and the richness of this energy mineral have been shared with people. So that's basically what we're looking at. The oil is the world is about to go into decline as regards its most important energy source. And that's really the issue at hand.
Just wondering what some other warning signs are. Like, a lot of people still hold quite fervently on the belief that we have enough oil to last us for another 50 years at least. And then you mentioned, for example, the confluence of military exploits and foreign policy with the oil industry. And I was wondering what kind of warning signs you suggest people to look out for, to what might give us a heads up as to when the peak might hit.
Yes, well, that's a very good question. The kinds of warning signs about the fact that we are around about this period of oil peak, more or less now, the general predictions now amongst those who are speaking out about this are somewhere between now and 2010, and increasingly the thoughts are that it'll be much sooner rather than later. 2010 in planning terms is more or less tomorrow anyway, so it's all soon, however you want to play it. Some of the warning signs, you mentioned, and we've both mentioned military activity. Very many people see the fact that Iraq has oil, one of the few places that appears to have quite a lot of oil left. I say appears to have because we can never really be quite sure, but I don't think there's any doubt that there's quite a lot there. It's extremely hard to picture a situation when all that effort would have been made to supposedly liberate the Iraqis, although to many of us it looks exactly like a very nasty form of colonial domination and imperialism, and I come from a country that practiced plenty of that, and that's what it looks like to me. So despite protestations to the contrary, it certainly looks like the effort that's being spent on Iraq is not because that they make fine carpets, but because they have oil. And I don't say it's the only reason, but it's an enormously important reason. And that could lead us to the second warning, which is that interruptions to the oil supply from the Middle East are regarded as incredibly important. And over the weekend, or just in the last couple of days, there have been more explosions in Saudi Arabia, and that suddenly pushed the oil price back up by about $1.60 or so in the last couple of days. And it didn't affect the oil supplies directly. Virtually no attacks yet in Saudi Arabia have, although there are those that have called for direct attacks on oil fields, and there have been some direct attacks on the oil process in Iraq. So the point there is, why are people deliberately attacking the oil supply system, or at least attacking it tangentially, as in the case of Saudi Arabia in the last couple of days, although they have, those who do these things, have attacked other places in Saudi Arabia which were more directly connected with the energy industry. Why would that make such a difference to the price? So it's just over 40 and it jumped up by nearly $2. Why could that possibly make such a difference to the price if everything were well? And the reason is, the reason why, for instance, a strike in Nigeria or even a strike in Norway, Norway of all places, has had a lot of unrest in its workforce in the last few months, and in Venezuela and many other places, why could that affect the price so dramatically? And that kind of price volatility hasn't really been seen in the oil industry, in the oil price. It has in the natural gas situation, which we'll talk about. And the reason is, we think, in fact, and increasingly being admitted even by the financial and other community, is that oil supply is very tight, demand is increasing, and so that's one of the warning signs, is not just that the oil price has gone up, which it has by a factor of, I think, almost 60% in recent times. So we went through $55 back in October. It's now back down by about $12 or $13, but it's fluctuating enormously. So the fact that it could have raced up to $55, which is 5.5 times what it was trading as in 1999, although the dollar has declined mightily since then, so we have to take that into account. Nonetheless, a huge rise. This is one of the best indications that all is not well. Whatever the industry says, all is not well. So that's a good place to look. And people, unfortunately, tend to, when one says oil, they think, oh yes, I'm paying a lot for it in my car. But that's gasoline, which is a product made from oil. And gasoline prices have a strange life of their own. There are so many other factors involved with that that you can't really tell all that much, certainly not on a week-to-week, month-to-month basis, on the price of, by the price of gasoline, or indeed petrol. In Europe, for instance, there's much more tax, so that can cushion that. So I would counsel people to become more energy literate and keep an eye on the oil price rather than many of the other things which they might be inclined to in the stock exchange. So that's one of the indicators. The fact that places like Shell have written down their reserves by over 20% in the last year, and there are some reports from the industry that Shell is going to write down reserves again. Write down reserves means that people say, well, we've got less than we thought. It's a bit more complicated than that, and one has to be careful about the conclusions one draws from that. But nonetheless, it shows that things aren't in good shape. Another of the signs to look for is look at Russia very carefully. What's going on in Russia is going to affect the world a great deal. Russia is the world's largest oil and gas producer now. It's a larger oil producer than Saudi Arabia. People may be surprised to learn. It's not the largest exporter. That's still Saudi Arabia. But nonetheless, Russia is the only place that has enormously increased its output in the last 5 years. Everybody else has inched it up or gone into decline. So a lot of eyes are on Russia, and what's going on with Yukos and other oil companies is of profound importance there. So those, I think, are some of the warning signs that are some of the bigger ones. I think we can expect to see the militarization, the further militarization of energy policy from the U.S. Another warning sign which comes along with that is look out, as more and more people are, look out at what China's doing. China, of course, has seen this enormous economic growth and has gone from being oil self-sufficient in about 1973 to importing about the same percentage as the U.S. The U.S. and China both import about 60% of their oil. Now, both these countries should look at this and say, this is absolutely demented, absolutely crazy. We're relying on our most important energy feedstock and really perhaps our most important import, full stop, most important thing that we have is oil, because so many things run on it in the transport system, for instance, virtually 100% runs on oil. Here we are with 60% of it coming from other places. And in America's cases, many of those places don't like America. And in China's case, this is less the case. But nonetheless, it's having to form relationships with people like Iran that the U.S. doesn't want it to. China seems quite happy to go and do this. And from China's point of view, it's probably quite a blessing. But what it's doing is complicating an ordinary, already very nasty and complicated world foreign affairs situation. And there is talk of some kind of, if I say clash, I don't necessarily mean military clash, but some kind of serious run-in between China and America before too long, and the same, a similar kind of thing could happen between China and Japan, whose relations are not very good these days, and one of the main places where they are competing with each other is again for energy supplies. So these are some of the things to look out for. I don't think it bodes terribly well, but it's going to mean that people were wise, to be honest, and want to get more energy literate, these are some of the places and some of the things to watch out for.
Thanks for the tips. And you mentioned natural gas, and it's true that peak oil is quickly becoming more and more public knowledge, but you're one of the relatively small number of people talking about natural gas as well. And I was wondering if you could explain why natural gas has potential to be a much bigger problem than that of oil depletion.
Yes, well, this gets us into extremely difficult territory in the case of Canada, and I will try to explain why. It's really quite complicated, and I apologize for that, but it's not my fault. I've explained it in some detail in my book on the natural gas crisis. The book is called High Noon for Natural Gas. For those that are interested in this, it's available from postcarbon.org, and it's also available, I hope, from bookshops. In this book, High Noon for Natural Gas, I've explained what's going on with natural gas around the world, and that means talking about natural gas in separate regions, because although the situation is changing, natural gas is what's generally called a regional product. And the region that one is most concerning, both to people who are natural gas in the natural gas industry, but also to North Americans, the reason that is most concerning is North America. And until recently, the U.S. was the world's largest producer of natural gas. That situation changed in the last 2, 3, 4 years, and Russia is now the world's largest producer of natural gas. And the problem for the U.S. was that although it was the largest natural extractor or producer of natural gas, it was also, as is so familiar, the world's largest consumer of natural gas. And although it's been producing a gigantic amount of gas for a long time, on the order at the moment of about, let's say, 19 trillion cubic feet a year, which is about a quarter of the world's, somewhere slightly less than a quarter of the world's gas. Although it produces that much gas, since the early 1980s, it just hasn't been enough. So for getting on 20 years now, despite being the world's largest producer, it was the world's largest user and using more than it produced. An unfortunately familiar situation. And the reason why it was able to actually increase its demand, even though its supply wasn't able to match it, was because of Canada. In Canada, came to natural gas much later than the U.S., and it's become an enormous producer, and indeed it became the second largest exporter gas, and all of those exports were to the U.S. And it increased dramatically from the 1980s, and that's what's propped up the U.S. natural gas consumption. Without that, it would just simply have had to have done something else about it, and it would have caused a lot of difficulties. So this situation, at least on the face of it, was all right for about 15 years or so, till about the year 2000, because Canada could go on dramatically increasing its natural gas production and sending more than half of itself. The same is true, by the way, of oil. Canada sends more than half of its roughly 3 million barrels a day south to the U.S. In fact, a lot of the time last year, for instance, Canada was the largest exporter, was the U.S.'s, America's, largest importer of oil. So it was larger than Saudi Arabia and larger than Mexico and Venezuela, which are all considerable exporters of oil to the U.S. So although Canada is extremely dependent on the U.S. for trade, America is extremely dependent on Canada for energy, also some electricity too. So we have this situation where everything seemed to be all right on the face of it, and prices which were very low for natural gas reflected this all throughout the 1990s. And then suddenly in the year 2000, at the same time there was the California energy crisis, which is connected to the natural gas situation in complex ways, suddenly the price of natural gas shoots up, and it's been extremely volatile ever since. And that's because not only has the U.S. Plateaued out in terms of its natural gas production, Canada hasn't really managed to plateau out. It's actually in decline. So this has had a dramatic effect on the natural gas situation in North America and in the U.S. in particular, so that the U.S. is now having to look at importing natural gas from other places, which is very difficult and means very expensive terminals, because gas, unlike oil, just can't be put in a bucket or indeed in a huge tanker and carried around the world. And it sits there and it behaves reasonably well unless something happens to the actual ship itself, in which case you can get an oil spill. But generally, given the amount of oil that's carried around the world, it happens relatively infrequently, although it's disastrous when it does. Natural gas can't be put in a normal vessel like that, certainly not in an oil tanker. If you're going to ship it, you more or less, at the moment anyway, you have to liquefy it and then produce something called LNG, liquefied natural gas. Then in order to transport it across the oceans, you have to put it in the world's most expensive civilian ships. They're also huge. The only thing that's larger is an aircraft carrier. And these liquefied natural gas carriers have to be filled from special liquefaction terminals, which are extremely expensive. The ships, as I say, are extremely expensive too. And then they have to go to very expensive gasification or regasification terminals in the importing country. And they also have to have pipelines in the producing country from the gas fields, because the gas fields are, with the exception of offshore gas fields, the onshore gas fields are fairly rarely right by the coast. There are some exceptions, but by and large they're not. So you need to have long pipelines to feed the liquefaction station. So you've got gas fields, pipelines, liquefaction plant, ships, then regasification plant, then more pipelines. Obviously the thing to do is to put the regasification plant near existing pipeline complexes, which can often be done, but not always. This is incredibly expensive. Somewhere between $3 billion and $10 billion for each train, and one calls it a train because the gas field through pipeline gasification ship regasification terminal, excuse me, liquefaction ship regasification terminal, more resembles a train than the oil situation, where you can have a tanker coming into virtually any place that can receive it. And one of the reasons, the other reason, not only is it a complex and heavy infrastructure business, hence the train, but it also, because of the expense, until recently anyway, most places have wanted to lock in 20 to 30 year contracts of supply to make sure they can get the gas, because otherwise the thing wouldn't be economic and they wouldn't get a return. So you've got this very complex structure that Japan has a huge amount of, and South Korea. Those are the two biggest liquefied natural gas importing places, have been for a long time. You've got to put all this structure in place. And for the U.S., it has only four terminals, which were built 20 or 30 years ago. And these are only capable of importing about 2 billion cubic feet a day. That's a little bit more now because they've been expanding them. And the U.S. uses anywhere between 50 and 60 billion cubic feet a day. So about 1/30, perhaps 1/20 of no more than 5% and often down to 2 or 3% of the gas. So in order to change the situation such that the U.S., for instance, could start to make up for the decline in Canadian gas production and exports and also its own plateau decline, it's facing the problem of having to build a lot of these terminals mighty quickly. And this is causing some difficulties. Most people don't want them in their backyards. I think that's quite a reasonable decision. So instead of them going into the U.S., there was thought that there are plans for them to go into Mexico, but Mexico has put up a surprising amount of resistance to this. So the first new LNG import terminals are going to go into Canada, mainly to serve the American market. So this is one of the typical complexities of this situation. But as I point out in my book, High Noon for Natural Gas, this situation is potentially extremely dangerous for Canada. It has trade implications. It has implications for this awful NAFTA agreement, which has just celebrated its 10-year anniversary. It's a very unfortunate agreement, and its energy agreement, Chapter 6, is a kind of noose which I think could potentially hang Canada. Then there's the other huge complex situation, and that is the tar sands. The tar sands, or as the oil industry fondly calls it, oil sands, but having just recently been to Athabasca, to Fort McMurray, and had a wonderful tour of many, indeed most of these facilities there, I can assure you it's not oil. It is indeed a mixture of tar and sand, or bitumen and sand with some clay and so forth. And yes, there's a huge amount of it. Actually, it's not nearly as difficult to extract as people might imagine. In fact, if you take a lump of this stuff and stick it in a beaker and pour in some hot water, it doesn't even have to be boiling, the sand and the clay will separate from the bitumen and the bitumen will float to the top. It's literally just like that. It happens before your eyes. The trouble is when you're trying to produce 1 million barrels a day of this stuff, then you have problems of scale. All absolutely feasible. It's happening right now. About 1 million barrels a day, scheduled to rise to 2 million barrels a day sometime in the next 10 years. There are some flies in this ointment, though. One is the water situation in Alberta, which there are increasing worries about. The other one is natural gas. The fact that natural gas is such an important component of tar sands extraction, it means that there is a connection between declining natural gas supply and production in Canada and its oil production. And it's going to become troublesome before the year 2010. And as energy goes into shortage in respect of demand and goes into all-out decline, you will find, I'm afraid, that it is a very complex situation. And there will be lots of easy answers thrown forward, and I'm afraid those easy answers will have to be countered with knowledge because there are no easy answers to this.
Would you be able to talk a little bit about some solutions? I know Post-Carbon Institute is big on relocalization, and I guess you've been working with some communities in California, I think, working, at least beginning to develop some ideas for how to survive this with any degree of self-sufficiency. And I'm wondering if you have any suggestions for the average person who doesn't have much of a say in what goes on in these energy issues.
Now, one of the things that can be done is precisely to get on more radio programs in particular, television if you can get it, and actually talk about this. So this is one of the inspiring stories that one can do, is learn as much as you can about this, and then write letters to the media. If you can get a column or if you can get an article, please do that. Do write to politicians. I do think we're in the English-speaking countries, we're in a very sad situation with politics. I think at the national level, there are no good English-speaking political leaders, and I mean that, none. At the local level, there are some people who are really trying hard. Local politics have more hope in it than national politics, which I think is an absolute disaster, and I think you can look south to America to confirm that. I don't think in Canada it's a very contentious thing to say that Mr. Bush is, I think, not a very helpful person to have commanding the world's largest economy and, unfortunately, the world's largest military system, and he seems to have no qualms about using it wherever and wherever he wants. But I think, given the very unfortunate macro political situation, there are some rays of light at the micro level, and one of the things that I strongly encourage listeners to do, and if there are listeners in the U.S. Hearing this, that too, and Britain and everywhere, is get involved at least at the local level of politics. So that's one of the first things. still some control in your municipal politics, you will find what we need to do next all the more difficult. So that's the first thing. Get involved in politics in any way that you can. Stand as a candidate, especially at the local level of politics, and really start working to awaken the political process to the magnitude of this energy problem and get the more of the public aware of it, both by media and by political means. And I should also say, while it's nice if one wins as a candidate, in another sense at this stage, at later stages, it will matter a lot more. But in one way, it doesn't matter, and that is the press will take notice of people standing as candidates. They will come and interview people, so it does help get the word out. So even if you think, oh, well, I've got no chance of winning whatsoever, it's utterly pointless. No, it's not. It's extremely important, number one, to have other voices, and perhaps with luck in this very broken pseudo-democracy that both Canada and the US have, awful first-past-the-post system, you may still be able to get in. Now, why is it so important, apart from getting the message out? The reason is that at the individual level, other than dramatically cutting down in energy use, which is tough to do, other than doing that on a personal basis, there's not much you can do at the individual level. That's why people must start working together with groups at the community level. There must be more coherent, as I call it, coherent action. The word collective has been scarred and tainted by its association with communism in the last century. So let's talk about coherence, and coherence is what you see in a magnet, where all the little magnetic particles, magnetized particles, line up, and instead of being able to do nothing, a magnet is able to pick up other magnetic things, particularly iron things, and so we can do work with that, and that's how electric motors work and a whole host of things work. So this kind of galvanization, this lining up of forces into the same direction is incredibly important, especially now for this energy situation. And that's because cutting down energy at the larger level is not, as I say, it's not something the individual can really do. It has to be done particularly at a medium level, at a municipal level, at a local level, at a community level, because we just don't have the structures to cut down our energy use in a dramatic way without that. Our cities are built wrongly, especially in North America. Our food system is built wrongly. We use an enormous amount of plastics. Plastics are made largely out of oil and natural gas. We consume an enormous amount of industrial food. Industrial food is more or less the transformation of oil and natural gas via the means of land. Land increasingly becoming problematic, by the way. Eroding, losing fertility, and water problems, irrigation problems. Now becoming apparent in Canada, but also threatening China and indeed threatening in America too. Transport system, of course, huge, by and large, there's not much one can do about transport except start walking again, start getting on your bicycle. If you have one or a horse, take public transport. But if you have to travel 50 miles to work a day, I don't think walking or bicycling or even a horse is a very sensible option. And the public transport largely doesn't exist for that. It does in Britain and in Europe. But one honestly has to say, is it wise to travel 50 miles to get to work? By the same token, because of the way we've built our work-life situation, for many people that's now the only option they've got. And this is pretty terrible. And this all leads to the policy that we call global relocalization. And global relocalization means relocalizing everything, absolutely everything, into the most local way you can manage for production and carrying of things, precisely because it makes no sense to have these long supply lines for our vital needs. Relocalize everything. The global part means do it in a widespread way, but also do it coherently. It's very noticeable that if you look at the history of humanity in the last 10,000 years, particularly, let's say, starting 8,500 years ago, from really the first large settlement at Çatalhöyük in Anatolia in what is now Turkey, 8,500 years ago, this settlement, which had some 6,000 or more people in it, which was probably the largest settlement at that time, one of the reasons why it became such a large settlement, it was the chief place for the transporting and the cohering, if you like, of both obsidian, which is a kind of volcanic glass, very useful for making sharp objects, and also for copper. Now, both of these things came from more than 100 miles away, so already we see that transport and trade was important to people 8,500 years ago, and it was supplying obsidian and copper to places hundreds and hundreds of miles away. So this is a warning to us that even as we relocalize and bring back our vital needs into the locale, we cannot get away from the fact that we do need to trade, and there will be many things that we can't get locally. But we must concentrate on our food, energy, and our water as being available locally. And also, we talk about the key things as being relocalizing food and energy and money. And in some ways, relocalizing money, getting control over your money, is going to be one of the hardest things to do. But I think it's going to be one of the most vital. It's another very, very complicated area. But unless we get some control over our money, which I think will mean building local money into our scenario, it'll be very difficult to prevent Chinese, and I'm not singling the Chinese out deliberately, but it'll be very hard to get control over the situation and not just be overwhelmed by cheap imports. It's a very complex issue. I won't go into it too much now. I'll just alert people, as part of the energy literacy campaign that we're promoting and developing, local money and understanding the peculiar situation of money is very, very important. These are all things that Post Carbon Institute, which you can go to at postcarbon.org, these are all things that we're developing and trying to tell people about. We do have a couple of very fine interviews about the money situation at globalpublicmedia.com, and particularly Richard Douthwaite has got a very interesting interview explaining more about why the money situation is locked into this whole mess, unfortunately. So food, energy, and money are absolutely key, and relocalizing those, but we have to be aware of the fact that for 10,000 years, total relocalization has been impossible, and if also that you don't get your neighbors to relocalize, you will get the potential very unfortunate situation is that, say you do manage to become quite self-reliant locally, if your neighbors don't and they get into trouble and they have bigger weapons than you, then I'm afraid what will happen is they will come and take what you've got. We've also been doing this for thousands of years, perhaps even tens of thousands of years, and we see an unfortunate tendency in certain primates, particularly chimpanzees, have a nasty tendency to go off in raiding parties, and so it looks like we've got several million years of a genetic tendency to do this. And this is, I think, is going to be one of our worst problems, and why we should regard violence as something that we need to basically control, because we're such a violent lot, and we are a violent primate. We're a paradoxical, problematic, violent primate, I'm afraid, with strong homicidal tendencies. We've got to get these better under control. And sometimes in history we've done a better job, and other times, like now, I think we're doing a spectacularly poor job. Particularly, I'm afraid, the Americans are showing signs of being absolutely out of control in terms of violence. And I think we have to speak out. We have to speak in terms of demilitarization. I know it's not going to happen by saying it, but almost no one is saying it. So when we talk of peace, let's first talk about de-armamentization. What a ghastly word. But anyway, reducing the amount of armaments, reducing the amount of weapons manufactured, weapons exports, and so forth. Almost nothing of the sort seems to be happening. And this is all tied up with the energy predicament. So it's very far from being a tangent. Iraq shows us that on a daily basis. But it actually manifests itself in our daily lives, especially in America, because a lot of the American economy depends on a huge corporate welfare, and that corporate welfare is being given to the Pentagon and the military to make weapons. And I think the manufacture of one weapon is a mistake, but the manufacture of millions and billions of weapons is just a catastrophic mistake. So these things are all linked together. Relocalizing is what we should be thinking of doing. That also means the relocalizing of light manufacturing capacity, because if you don't produce some of these important objects locally, then you're just going to fall back on other people who do make them, and by and large these are the global corporations. And I should say also that this, whilst I'm at it as it were, that the presence of global corporations is very much part of the problem. And I think that the form of a corporation is extremely obnoxious. It's very dangerous. I think there is no such thing, I'm sorry to say, as a good corporation, and I think we should be working very hard to get ourselves away from being dependent on corporations. We have a policy called corporate disobedience. It's based on the idea of civil disobedience, but it's completely legal by definition. Civil disobedience isn't. Corporate disobedience just means this. If you are not under contract to buy something from a global corporation, then don't buy it. If you haven't signed a mortgage agreement, if you haven't signed a car payment agreement, then if you possibly can, don't. If you possibly can, don't take on a mortgage, don't take on a car purchase agreement, don't buy it. Don't buy that can of Coca-Cola, Pepsi-Cola. Don't buy that can of fizzy drink, and don't enter into these large agreements if you possibly can. I mention these fizzy drinks because they're very bad for people, and food in general is one of the places where global corporations have got such a lock on us because they supply via the industrial food system. They supply so much of our daily needs. And these are the two things to look at in terms of disconnecting, reducing our dependence on the global corporate machine, which, by the way, means global corporate energy, big energy. You look at your daily expenditure, which is one of the biggest ones, is food, and which are small items, but they all add up to a huge amount, and look at mortgage and car payments, because these are the big ones, which also add up to a lot. And I do look at certain pronouncements that people make, and I say, well, that's all very well, but do you own a car? Do you have a mortgage? If you do those two things, then I'm afraid large-scale hypocrisy is being indulged in, because as long as you do those two things and keep buying large amounts of corporate food, which I'm afraid also includes a lot of flesh, too, at an individual level, if you can reduce the amount of flesh that you eat, that means fish and meat, if you can reduce that dramatically, better still get off it, but it's much better at least to reduce it, and yes, tell other people too as well. I know we're not supposed to tell other people to do anything, but we're going to have to get over that and start doing that, because it's very important to let other people know that there are other things that they can do. Unless you are not locked into that system, it seems to me there's a great deal of hypocrisy going on, and I think the corporations just laugh at all the kind of green left expostulations and say, oh, that's it, you just go on saying all that, but keep on with the mortgage, keep on with the car, keep on with buying lots of flesh, keep on with buying corporate food, and we don't really care what you say. In fact, it'll make a very nice tagline for our next commercial, so thanks for the idea. And that's exactly what's happened. And it's exactly what is happening. So it's going to expose a lot of fault lines in the so-called progressive camps. Indeed, it's going to call the whole notion of progress seriously into question. In point of fact, global relocalization does call the notion of progress into question, because progress is just generally tended to mean more industrialization, more technology, more energy, more everything, more stuff to go into the landfill. So it's going to be pretty uncomfortable. I should also say, just as I mentioned that from the first moments of large settlements, which we can identify going back 8,500 years, I mentioned obsidian and copper, obsidian being this volcanic glass and copper. We know what that is. Why were these things important? Well, these were early forms of technology. So another thing that we just cannot imagine, we can't just dump technology. We are a technological primate. We're stuck with it. We're stuck with agriculture, unfortunately. I think it was a mistake, but there we are. It was made 10,000 or so years ago. We've compounded it ever since, so we're not just going to get away from technology and agriculture. Basically, I think we won't get away from it until the time that the human species is extinct. So once again, just like violence, what we have to do is control our agriculture, control our technology, and try to use it in a much more sensible way, use less of technology, and use less, much less, industrial agriculture. In fact, we're going to have to get off industrial agriculture this century. That's going to be very, very problematic. And you mentioned, to tie this together, you mentioned the shorter growing season in Canada, and actually the less fertile soils and the water problems in some places. There is no easy answer to this, and it looks like another bad year for Canadian agriculture. I'm afraid, unless one analyzes the situation in Canada with a rather kind of gimlet eye, nature is likely to do it for us. I don't think Canadian agricultural production can continue at the level that it's been. That has very serious implications, and relocalizing agriculture, I think, is something that's very, very important. And if your growing season is short, then you have to adapt to it. Greenhouses are an interesting phenomenon. I wouldn't like to see the whole places covered with greenhouses, but nonetheless, they take energy to heat, by the way, and they often take natural gas to heat them. So looking very seriously at the Canadian growing situation is exactly what should be done, and getting off industrial agriculture is also what should be done. So there aren't easy answers to this, and as biomass, which means trees and corn and other things, starts to become more prominent in the energy mix, the renewable energy mix, I should say, then the issue of land, soil fertility, and so forth is only going to rise higher. And I know at this stage the traditional sort of the mainstream Greens will say, well, my God, he hasn't mentioned renewables. He hasn't mentioned conservation and efficiency. Well, I will mention those things. I think they have to be done in tandem with using much less energy. I mean, that's what it comes back to. Relocalization also won't work unless we use dramatically less energy. The reason why I leave mentioning these traditional, if you like, the conventional green point of view till the end is, my great fear is that we'll try and just substitute our way out of this. We'll just try and put in windmills and solar panels all over the place. And I don't believe that's a good way forward to try to substitute. I do believe we should try to use renewables as much as we can, but we must say to ourselves, we've got to use much less big energy, and yes, let's put in renewable energy and let's use it where we can, but let's not pretend we can just substitute our way out of their mess. Let's reduce our energy and our material throughput on the one hand, and then we may be able to manage with renewables, and we won't need to try and carpet the Nevada desert with solar panels, which is what some people have suggested. And there are various reasons why this is ludicrous and why we won't have to turn to imaginings about zero-point energy or the great hope of fusion reactors, which has been always 30 years in the future for the last 50 years. So this is why I don't mention renewables till the end. We do, in fact, promote, and we're very interested in renewables, but we'd like to see renewables and the renewable harvesting machines, both the wind turbine machines and the solar panels and the solar cells, we'd like to see those being manufactured locally or at least regionally. So we do have something to say about this, and I think it's very important. But let's talk about relocalizing that too, otherwise we're just going to be buying them from Japan, and there are all kinds of bottlenecks from trying to buy Japanese solar panels, and it doesn't make any sense, unless you're a Dane, to be buying half of America is buying roughly half its windmills from Denmark. Why not make them locally in America, locally in Canada, and produce a lot more employment, which is going to be sorely needed, because one of the things that's going to happen as the energy tsunami, and I've used that term in the past today, given what's happened in Asia, tsunami has a particularly dreadful ring to it, but it is a terrifying thing. I think as this energy tsunami hits us, there's going to be enormous unemployment, so we must do everything we can to increase employment and not just produce these rotten McJobs, these low-paying, soul-destroying jobs. And a lot of the Industrial Revolution for the last 250 years has been about rotten, low-paying, undignified jobs, to put it mildly. Let's bring and try and create some decent, reasonable, helpful, useful jobs for people, which they can find not only will give them a reasonable living, but have some dignity to them too. So I think making local energy harvesting machines, by which I mean solar panels, solar cells, wind turbines, relocalizing that is very, very important. And the other thing which traditional Greens get up in arms about is, well, why don't you mention efficiency? Conservation, as long as conservation means using much less, I'm very keen on conservation. The trouble with efficiency, and Bill Rees here in British Columbia, the inventor of ecological footprinting, Bill Rees points this out, and Bill Rees, by the way, is a tireless proponent of getting the word out in terms of oil peak, and we strongly support him and others doing this. Linda McQuaig, I've mentioned, in Canada. There are a couple of other petroleum geologists doing this too. Dave Russom is another of them, and Dave Hughes as well. They are to be supported in their efforts to let Canadian public know about the Canadian situation here. But what is the problem with efficiency? Well, it's been noticed over and over again now that if you just get more efficient, unfortunately, it stimulates the economy. It just produces more growth. And that ties up another very important area, or points to another important area in this. Growth is deeply part of the problem. Because we just keep the economy growing, that ultimately always means more energy. And so what happens is you try and do efficiency. But in doing efficiency, it tends to make the industrial process work better. And you might say, well, that's grand, isn't it? No, it's not grand. It actually ultimately increases the economic demand. That increases economic growth. That increases the demand for energy, the demand for material throughput, which means more mining, more of all the mess that goes along with that, all the mess that goes along with material products, all the mess that goes along with more landfills. And ironically and ultimately, not only does it increase all the industrial mess, it actually, in aggregate, increases energy demand. It's happened over and over again. And in point of fact, in this rather poverty-stricken Canadian energy scenarios, which was put forward last year for Canada's energy future, the techno-vert, the technological green proposal scenario that was put forward actually ends up increasing energy demand. So that's what happens when you go for efficiency, which is why I'm not very keen to promote efficiency. It's much better to think, how can we get our absolute energy demand down and our absolute material throughput down? If you measure that and not worry too much about energy, then I think that's a much better track to be on. And the whole growth business is really one of the things that's at the bottom of this. I mean, empire is at the bottom of its need to expand markets, the connection with capitalism. And just to finish up and to tie it all together, the need for growth is really what's at the bottom of this. Growth needs to happen because markets need to grow forever. Markets need to grow forever because one of the reasons, one of the major needs, is the demands of the money system. And it is this money system, which I alluded to earlier on, which is one of the reasons why we need local money. The money system must keep expanding because it's a debt-based, interest-bearing, fractional reserve system. I won't go into all those things now. I do explain this in the last chapter of my book, which is What Else Can We Do? I do, in fact, spend 40 pages talking very little about natural gas and a great deal about how to reduce your energy demand. And one of the things I've explained in there in a few pages is this peculiar, dreadful, pathological money situation we've got. It's the money, perhaps more than anything else, which keeps the need for growth, keeps that up. We need to keep expanding. That keeps expanding energy demand. So we have to do something about our money system. And the money system really has developed along with our need to keep dominating, our need to keep taking places over, our need for empire and colonization. So these things are all tied together, and they reach their most perfect embodiment in capitalism. And I regard capitalism, along with Ken Livingstone, as the worst system that's ever been foisted on the planet. It's worse, actually, than communism. I regard communism as no answer either. Communism did a great deal of damage. It produced societies that were very unfree, clearly, and caused the death and suffering of many people, and it was very problematic. It wasn't all bad. It has some good things about it, but I think if we want those good things, we better find another way of doing it. But capitalism, I'm afraid, is actually worse.
I want to ask a question I was thinking of. What's your feeling? Are you excited? Are you inspired? Are you just kind of riding the wave?
Well, gosh, here's the part that's inspiring. You asked me a little while back about were there any good stories, and you did mention California. It is the case that groups of people who do understand the seriousness of the situation and who do, I think, realize that very sadly our national political leaders and our national corporate leaders seem to show absolutely no interest in facing this problem. They won't even admit to it, by and large.